The HSJ Health Check podcast is sponsored by Cisco.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm Dave West, HSJ's deputy editor. Annabelle Collins, our normal host, is away today, so I'm free to indulge myself and talk about a good old-fashioned row about NHS finances, which in this terrible year is perhaps something familiar that we can hold on to while also being an area where we are seeing some very important developments at the moment. Joining me to talk about this topic are Tom Norton, HSJ's finance correspondent, Sharon Brennan, our senior correspondent for integration, and Ben Clover, one of our bureau chiefs. And Tom Norton, can I ask you to first of all bring us up to date briefly with the developments this week on the NHS financial system?
Yes, of course. So last month, or the past month and a half, we heard there would be a change to how the finances of NHS would be managed. And obviously, at the start of the crisis, it was all finances were managed on a block through system. However, at the end of July, new performance targets were released to encourage systems and providers to get up to the activity levels seen pre-pandemic. Shortly after, these were followed by a number of financial incentives and penalties, in essence, that would be tied to that activity at a system level. Providers were then told to put together their system plans for the rest of the year so that the allocations for month 7 to month 12 could be calculated. After some delay this week, those were published to providers along with the guidance that followed, which stated that the purchaser provider mechanism has been a subject of plenty of as you say, plenty of argument and debate historically, seems to be on hold or on pause, at least for the time being. Many are speculating is the end for it. As for now, the systems will be managing allocations given to them by the Treasury. All providers within systems will be required to contribute to activity totals that, if aren't met, will mean that systems as a whole will see their overall funding envelopes reduced, or, you know, if they manage to overperform, increased during the course of the year.
And one, before we get into talking about some of the rows, you know, which we've seen some big names in the NHS leadership weigh into this week. One of the important questions always for NHS finances and when the money's being shared out at a time like this essentially financial allocations for the rest of the year for the different parts of the NHS. One of the big questions is there enough money to go around, basically? If there is enough money, then you broadly find that people are kind of happy enough with it and they get on with it. If it's much tighter, then they're not so. And clearly there's big consequences as in terms of the services that they can run for patients. Do you get the sense people feel there is enough money to go around this time?
Well, it's a bit difficult to say at the moment because some finance leads are still going through reading through the allocations that were published only on only a few days ago to try and work out. And I've asked plenty of them who've said that you're still going to need at least a week and into next week to get an estimate. But some are saying it's a mix. We understand that there are some who may wish to negotiate renegotiate the allocations that have been provided. Others I've spoken to have said that there are gaps that they haven't got what that they would have hoped for from the Treasury, but that a lot of it will have to depend on month 7 to month 12. You know, plenty of factors to consider in whether or not the gap will see them through. And I guess the concern it probably might be a little bit bumpy. As of complicating it as well, we still don't know what the total overall figure has been sort of granted. If there's a collective total for the allocations that have been provided by the Treasury for the remaining months of 1920, I think at the moment the feeling is a kind of mixture of let's wait to see how it goes. It's all going to be very dependent on how we might be able to recover income, increase activity, what the impact of COVID might be. There is obviously some anxiety that, you know, whatever happens over the next until the end of the financial year, this could lead to the kind of unorganized sort of messy system at the beginning of the next financial year. But I would say a mixture of sort of anxiety and uncertainty.
Makes sense. Okay, thank you. Ben and then Sharon, too. On the, you know, as Tom mentioned, this is arguably a historic shift. There's been a lot of talk over the last few years about the NHS trying to move away from its internal market, but actually getting the financial rules changed has been, you know, virtually impossible. Getting the rules changed away from that internal market has been with us since about 1990. Ben, first of all, you've covered acute hospital care for quite a while. Does this look like a historic shift to you?
I'm going to be annoying and say kind of yes and no. Yes, in that they've actually said it, and they've actually said it's going to happen. It's arguably not the most significant part of the things they've announced, though. And no, in that people have been kind of tiptoeing away from the system for quite a while in many areas. I mean, it's worth remembering, even though, like you say, it was sort of introduced by Kenneth Clark and in the Conservative administration in the 90s, it really took on its classic form when Labour pumped a bunch more money into the NHS. They pumped a bunch more money into it in the noughties, but said we want this to operate on better sort of market principles, like the market would. It only ever to call it a market is often to kind of overstate it. Really, because in the classic idea is kind of the classic idea was, I'm sorry, but the rationale for that, the public rationale for it was, we've got these huge waiting lists, we need to incentivize hospitals to blast through these. So rather than kind of going, here's your budget for the year, do your best, you'd instead say, we will pay you for each unit of activity you do. So suddenly your orthopedics department that may have slightly sluggishly been kind of going, hey, look, we're doing our best, here's what we can do, and often we can't get hold of a consultant, that kind of thing, was suddenly being told, if you do an extra 50% of procedures, you will get an extra 50% more of money, and then we can do the trust and your department can do much more with that. That was the thinking, was we're going to blast through the waiting lists by incentivizing efficiency. In practice, it can't be overstated how much proper market rules didn't function in the NHS, because if you give the money to the clinical commissioning group or the PCT back in the day, and you say, in theory, the commissioners were supposed to say, well, here's our budget of £80 million a year for hospital services for the people of Barnsley. Where shall we spend it? Why, I think Barnsley Hospital seems ideally in practice, there was very little dynamism in the market. It was a pretty sluggish facsimile of a market. I mean, it's not to say it didn't work in some places. I mean, it was almost like it was designed to really work in things like elective procedures, which is, and that also meant that you could incentivize the private sector to come in and do a bunch of NHS procedures, and the idea is that would G up the NHS services. Labour did a thing called ISTCs, independent sector treatment centres, which are supposed to do exactly that on tariff. But broadly, like tariffs have been cut steadily. Like the unit cost that people were paid for things got cut steadily. So, overall, as a system, we've been retreating from it for some time, because you can see that just by how everyone's in a pretty much every provider is in a deficit now. Well, the acute providers are pretty much all in deficit under the old rules, and they weren't 5 years ago. So kind of the fundamental thing is the fundamental factors underneath our activity has gone up, and what trusts are paid for it has gone down. So those yawning deficits you've seen are just the difference between activity and what people can cope with, basically.
Okay. So in that context, you say it's not that historic, because really this is all it's all shades of grey.
Well, there's so many. I'm sure that there are so many kind of shades of grey in it. I mean, what it will, and like in some places have been on block contracts for years, or cap and collar contracts. But I mean, but it is significant that they've finally said, all right, well, these are going to be the rules now. That is undeniably significant, and it's going to have significance in lots of little areas. Like, so for example, I think part of the problem with it previously was the private sector did the private hospital sector in England did a fair old slug of NHS funded work, you know, kind of like north of £1 billion. And if you suddenly rip up the competition rules and the market, then NHS commissioners could just kind of go, all right, well, all this work's going back in house, and that's obviously, it would be technically illegal. It would be a very ugly court case, obviously, to kind of, because an important thing to understand is that, like, really hardly anyone in the public, and lots of people in health, don't really understand that there was a quasi market in operation anyway. They just see it as there's the NHS providing its services. So this whole sort of playing shop that the NHS has been doing for 20 years, that hasn't been very real in lots of places ever, although in some places it's very real. So sorry, that's a very shades of grey argument, but it is significant that they put on the record. I think maybe more significant is that, and like lots of our commenters have been saying, is that if you really are going to try and hold non-statutory bodies to account, because that was the other thing to note about this system is, however sort of unreal it was in many ways, people can and did lose their jobs off going hugely into deficit on these rules, even if they were eminently gameable. And sometimes, I mean, a recent example of how gameable they are, kind of the different rules that NHS England put in on control totals, would see people do like dodgy stuff, like sell one of their buildings to their charity, get this huge lump sum from their charity, and then that puts them over the threshold to get another big performance lump sum from the centre.
There were very strong incentives there, you know, although, as you said, the incentives have become very confused and convoluted. They have sort of over many years has evolved, but they did remain very strong incentives, as you say, to do some very sort of substantial things in terms of selling assets. Whereas now we have had, at the very least, have had a big step change in what incentives are this year. And we don't know what that will do. I mean, I think it's, at the very least, there's been a step change in incentives, and which will affect how people behave. Sharon, you sort of spend your time talking to people involved in integration, one way or another, whether that be an integrated care system leader or a sort of someone who's involved in trying to improve or protect care for people with long term conditions and so on. How do they see this shift?
Well, I think this shift, it seems to confuse two things, and it does seem to jump the gun a bit. I mean, to be fair to STPs, they were told they had until April 2021 to become an integrated care system, and we are quite significantly ahead of that target, and bearing in mind a lot of that work to become an ICS was significantly slowed down during COVID and the coronavirus pandemic, not least the merging of CCGs. So some of this does feel like it's come in too early. A lot of areas, you know, yet again, you'll have areas where they can do it and areas where they can't. So the ones which we always talk about that are really good, like Dorset and West Yorkshire and Surrey, will probably be able to do this. They probably already started thinking about, you know, how you manage finances across the system. Other areas which are struggling just to become an ICS, and bearing in mind, we've now been talking that some may just be waved through in April, but won't quite be there in terms of being able to kind of function as an integrated care system. Those people will struggle. And as we always say, there is no ICS in statutory legislation, which this financial guidance recognises, because it can't give the money to an ICS because the ICS doesn't exist. So it's telling the ICS to nominate a lead CCG, because obviously, you know, it was hoping there'd be one CCG per ICS by April 2021, but that is, you know, still a fair chunk away. So the money has to sit with one CCG. And a lot of places just aren't ready yet to have those. You know, the hardest bit about integrating any care system is the money. People can do the relationships, they can see the pathways, they can see the benefit for the patients. But as soon as they start worrying, start thinking about, you know, an acute trust losing X million because they've got to give it to community area, it's really hard. They are the hardest conversations to have. And it's almost as if NHS England and I have accelerated those conversations at a time when really the system needs to be focused on the second wave. So I think it is quite a significant change. And I actually think it's harder than we expected. I mean, I wrote a piece a month ago about whether or not system waiting lists would be mandated. And there was debate whether or how that would be done, whether it would be done through monitoring and measurement. But actually, it looks like that's now going to be done through finances, because effectively, you don't meet your elective targets as a system, you get less money. So that's a hard and fast push to tell people to work together and work out who's got the capacity to do what type of operations. So I think it's quite a significant change. I think it's come really early. And I think, listen to some of the comments and the criticisms, it might well have been better to have put some of this money through system funding and yet allowed the elective waiting list to be managed in a slightly different way, given that it's, you know, Ben will know more, but it's, you know, kind of ballooned beyond comprehension.
I suppose it's significant,
and I think early.
It's an interesting point about, you know, thinking about that, then we'll move on to the row next. But the criticism being that that the tariff was there to drive elective activity, and at the moment the NHS's biggest problem is an elective waiting list, or it's, you know, what has been given to it as its biggest problem. So why ditch tariff? Whereas there is a sort of practical service management gamble here. In that people are saying, actually, we don't think that is the best way to deal with this. We think the best way to deal with an elective waiting list is to encourage you to work together so you can share out the activity, and people are identifying these elective hubs, you know, essentially centralizing things in a way that if they were working on tariff, a trust would have said, well, there's no way I'm giving up my urology or whatever to so-and-so over there, because this is a tariff issue. And whereas under the collaborative model, they perhaps will agree to do that, or they may agree to do just generally less elective and become the COVID.
Yeah, the COVID and center. I think that is a good idea. But I think the problem sits in the fact that financially money will be taken away from systems who can't afford to lose that money at the moment. And also the elective weights could be affected by anything. I mean, at the moment, there's a big issue with test and trace and whether or not people can get the tests they need to go ahead and have an operation. We've got issues about staff, whether they can get tests to get done and you know, carry on staffing these kind of elective caseload. So, I mean, I can see a genuine reason why people are worried about why that's coming now. And it's also expecting CCGs and trusts to put a massive acceleration on integration plans at a time when really there needs to be a massive focus on managing the second wave, pushing through the electives and preparing for winter. So it does seem a strange time to be putting in huge financial incentives and disincentives around elective work, although the principle of it, of system management of finances, I think is worthwhile, because you can't move to an integrated care system if you don't start looking at your finances as a whole, as a system. Otherwise, effectively, it's just organisations working together under kind of a fake banner of being an ICS.
Okay, all right, thanks. And so, and you know, as we've alluded to, Tom, some big names have waded into the discussion about this. Could you Could you tell us what is the row?
Yes, I mean it's sort of along the kind of lines that that Ben and Sharon have been talking about, that Glenn Burley and Michael Wilson on our HSJ comments section have been quite critical. Acute Tree Trust chief executives have both said that the system that was being proposed isn't going to incentivize the activity levels that the NHSE is demanding in its phase three recovery and beyond, and that the tariff-based system is the most they consider to be the most effective way of not only incentivizing trusts but making sure that money moves effectively through the system. Of course, the counterpoint is that this is a step change in the right direction for managing system finances. And that the system is qualified and ready to be able to take on this responsibility. I mean, Ed McAllister Smith, who's also a former local NHS chief exec, he's argued on our forum that the NHS already has vast experience working at a system level, and we need only to look at that experience, and it's it's still the advantage of acute financial trust who've been working as these sort of he describes it as a kind of quasi-commercial bodies, and looking at all the kinds of stresses and unintended consequences this has had for the NHS, and that this system brings sort of parity between partners and between providers and organisations who've sort of squabbled around within the internal market system for the rewards that payment by results provides. Their arguments are perhaps not surprising. They amplify feeling that has existed and been debated for a while, but it was surprising to see so many of the top bosses speak on the record about their misgivings or compliments toward the system that's being developed.
Yeah, they certainly sounded very affronted about it, particularly Michael Wilson, and Sussex chief exec, actually saying he thinks that the changes to financial incentives implying more so than coronavirus are actually to blame for the very large waiting list at the minute, because there have been shifts to these, as Ben said, to these kind of non-tariff incentives over quite a period.
Find that puzzling, if his contention is the overall, and it's been growing steadily, like before coronavirus, the total number of waiters, the median time they've been waiting on an active list had been growing steadily, and I haven't seen any evidence that that the NHS has done. So the number of referrals into the system continues to grow. The amount of work that the system does has increased only slightly over the last couple of years. So there is a gap there that's going to account for a lot of that difference. But I'm not sure if there's any evidence that the existing local cap and collar or block arrangements, the effectively taking people off piecework rates and paying them a flat rate, has seen a big old slackening off of if that's caused the plateauing of elective activity. I mean, there's also been increased pressure everywhere, on the non-elective stuff, which obviously causes cancellations and delays. I mean, there's like pretty fundamental capacity issues at work there. So it's certainly interesting to say block contractors has caused that issue, because I'm not sure there would have been the money to pay for all of the extra work to keep pace with that extra demand, even if people had, emboldened by the tariff system, done it all, you know.
Why do you think those people are so angry about it?
I don't know. It's because it is such a complicated picture, where lots of places, the places that were always historically under allocated money, and often as a result became kind of performance basket cases. So before Michael Wilson got to Surrey and Sussex, that place was a kind of a performance basket case, kind of. And like when trusts don't have enough resource to do what they need to do, it seems to follow fairly quickly that you get all these kind of cultural and performance issues as people go down into a kind of behavioral way into a, well, not my problem, Gov. I just do the lists I'm given kind of thing. And I think one of the happy tidings of the whole COVID thing is that the kind of the managerial class has been really impressed by how medical leadership has sort of risen up in a way, because, like, you know, there's been a lot more proactive integration of the kind medically led that people have been hoping to see for a while, and the medics would say, well, you know, we're not incentivized to do this in the current system, but it seems like the direction of travel is we want you, the workforce who deliver this work, to kind of stop thinking of yourself as someone who's like, well, I work at the UHCW and I just do my shifts there, do a bit of private, whatever, to kind of go, but no, you are instead to think of yourself as you are an orthopedic surgeon for NHS Warwickshire. And if we need you to drive like up the road 20 miles to cover this list, then please do so. Or if we've turned part of this trust into a kind of COVID hot site and we're going to relocate everything else somewhere else, then we need you to act as if you're
to
not
accept really, that and not yeah. fight against it,
but not, really. Yeah, to not kind of go, well, look, I'm technically employed by this trust and I will not be driving 30 miles up the road to do and it's also okay. It's important, like, that there's loads of little odd commercial deals that trusts and sometimes systems have done with, you know, private providers or technology companies that are very tariff incentivized and aligned. Like, if your referral management system can stop this many people coming through onto the waiting list, then we will pay you this amount of a tariff we otherwise would have had to pay out. Like, what happens to those deals? Like, there's going to be a lot of work for lawyers, I imagine.
I think it's how you're used to running an organization, isn't it? If you can run your organization on the basis of these kind of incentives and the identity and attachment and delivering for your service or your division or your organization, and then that's being taken away from you as the chief exec, as the person who's running this stuff, then it's hard, isn't it? Sharon, what about yourself? Did you have any sort of integration perspective on that, on that row?
Well, no, I think the thing I've found quite interesting from what Ben's been talking about is this issue around the independent sector, because that's never been resolved. And that has always been something that has kind of been put in the kind of too hard to sort out now category. People are really aware that in an ICS, they don't really want to be contracting outside of their area because it keeps a pound within it. But there is a mandated and consistently upheld need for patients to be able to choose, which does include private sector capacity to be able to offer that choice. So Ben was saying about mitigations and things, that's never been solved. And I don't know, you know, like, yet again, I think this has kind of come, you know, this idea has kind of come rather early when you haven't, you know, some of this nitty gritty stuff, which, you know, is essential really for getting through some of this work that we're talking about and kind of helping systems maintain their income, hasn't yet been resolved. So, and I also, going off on Ben's point about people driving 30 miles to a different area, we've had that conversation in some areas such as Basildon, where staff were asked from the South End to go to Basildon and staff their ICU, and they felt very much that they didn't want to do that, and yet were being pressured by their contract to have to. And it seems to be that they can just tell people to move, but that doesn't really help retention and staff morale. So I think, you know, what looked like quite a simple, well, not a simple, but what we thought was, you know, a story about finances and like a big shift in like a historic shift, as, you know, as Tom's article described it, seemed to be opening up more and more issues that haven't really been thought through. And I can't imagine being solved in the next couple of months without distracting from the main task of getting through electives.
Yeah, I mean, for the sort of the things, I think we're kind of assuming it can't go back. And I've heard a lot of, you know, senior NHS leaders saying, well, we can't go back to that old way. But I'm not sure it's, I think that assumption could dry up pretty quickly, actually, if it's not working that well. And actually, we're coming into a new financial year and, or, you know, perhaps not for the next financial year, but the subsequent one. You know, there's nothing to say this sort of water can't flow back up the hill on that.
I think one of the concerns I would have is that they push something quite early where people maybe aren't ready to deal with it, and that loses all the good faith of if they launch it kind of later next year and build up people's ability to cope with it. You might well have had more people involved and invested, but as you've pointed out now, like if it doesn't work, then what do you do? Do you go back? And that could well be just a case of it doesn't work because the timing wasn't right. So I can see this rolling on for quite a while.
They need to get some proper finance directors, don't they? I thought it was interesting, you know, talking about integrated care systems, which are being, in theory, are being, on paper, being allocated these big, huge dollops of funding. I think it's happened in Lancashire because David Flory, who was, you know, the finance director of the NHS for quite a long time, has become the chair of the Lancashire integrated care system over the last few months, hasn't he? I think I saw they then moved an actual trust finance director into the position of finance director of the ICS, because asking an ICS to make these kind of take on these kind of budgets and make these sort of decisions without a proper finance director or a finance department, as anyone would know, is as you say, feels rather cart
before
horse.
But that in itself is really strange, Dave. I mean, I talked to this through with Dave, Tom, the other day. ICSs don't exist and they don't have any money. They don't have any ability to hold it. So the only way they can have this cash is when the people, kind of a finance director has basically to rely on the other organisations to give them the power to do what they want to do, because they don't exist as a thing. So I think finance directors are probably really important. But again, it doesn't surprise me that the ICS you discussed was Lancashire, because that's one of the ones that's doing better. I think we're probably seeing a big divide now between people being able to manage this as a system of people not, and whether or not that then means that you'll have regional NHSE, NHSI coming in and, you know, pushing hard on systems that can't cope with this demand. We'll see. But it doesn't surprise me that that's one of the good ones. The good STP we always roll out quite a lot when we talk about things. But,
well, it's all right. Also, I'm run by Dave Florian. I mean, you need to. They can have influence to the extent that NHS England and Improvement do what they say. And if you've got, you know, someone like David Florian as the chair, then you know, they will. If he tells everyone around him, well, don't give them any money, give the money to these lot, then you know, presumably, as long as they've got trust in that it's working, then they may well do that. And
but trust doesn't override legal the legal obligations that the trust has and the CCG has. So again, we're still sitting in that position where there's a willingness and a trust to do something, and there's the legal obligation of your organisations pointing in a different direction. So like I said, I think this is a bit early. If everyone had a ICS financial directors in place and they said, well, let's get this done by April and then we'll do it, then I think we would have more chance of success. Now I think there's quite an opportunity to push back, like you said before, and maybe say this isn't going to work, and it could actually just derail the financial integration of systems further rather than actually speed it up.
Yeah, maybe that's a good sort of note to end on, Tom, if you could tell us about the, because actually there is no permanence to this arrangement, is there? There's, you know, what Sharon was saying reminded me of I think we've already reported a little on the kind of the immediate negotiation which is going on between the people who've received these allocations, their chief execs and finance directors, coming back straight away and saying, well, actually, no, that's not what allocation should be, and essentially negotiating to and fro. And so whether there's actually quite a lot more money sitting in the centre with NHS England, or, you know, and we have no idea whether the Treasury will actually, if there is some kind of substantial second peak, surely we have to expect the Treasury would hand over more money anyway. So there's a lot of kind of toing and froing to come. Is that a fair expectation for the rest of this financial year?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's something I wanted to mention, is that there is plenty of talk about the significance of you know, what does this change mean? And both in terms of system integration and the internal market. But these plans are gestatory. I mean, they've come out of the back end of the arrangements made in March, which was just this block contracting arrangement. Again, managed through systems. I'm not tied to performance, but you know, CCGs within their role within systems would you know allocate blocks through that. There are these incentive targets that are being tied to it. It's all a little bit. Those targets in themselves are quite global. You know that like I think that there's a great deal more thought that's going to be put into this. And if we're talking about thinking about measures like place, there'll be a lot of discussion between now and the end of the year about saying, well, you know, you're tying 80 to 100% activity figures for all these systems, but look at what we're doing and the allocations that we've provided. There's going to be kind of a lot of biting back. And I don't know. It has accelerated the pace of system working, and I think maybe it could just be there as a sort of continuation of the simplified arrangement that existed or that were brought in at the beginning of for the benefit of finance directors, rather than really being a sort of flag in the ground of saying, and this is how we're going forward, because it all sounds a little bit underhand when you argue about this as a whole shift move in how NHS finance is managed, in so much as that, oh well, you know, this is the opportunity for us to do it. You know, we've got some flexibility here. Let's do this now and forever. Shall this regime remain in place? It seems strange. And I mean, again, in between all of this, we have the comprehensive spending review to add even more conversation about, you know, around allocations. And you know, obviously systems have taken a leading role in management of capital spending, whatever the revenue spending announcements that'll be made out of the CSR are going to influence the scope of this regime. It's really, again, just going back to what you sort of said at the beginning, you know, that there's nothing quite like a good row about NHS finances. And I would say that the concerns and warranted and the debate are warranted, but without trying to sound too fence city, there's so much more to iron out before the end of March. What the Treasury may or may not provide for the DH between now and then is going to influence that too, and we don't know what shape that might take in spring, or well, who knows.
They may be hoping that NHS financial regime is the biggest thing they have to worry about over the next 6 months, I suppose. All right. Well, thanks very much. Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. You can subscribe via apps, and we'll speak to you next week.